cruelty, very far from being a vice, is the first sentiment nature injects in us all. The infant breaks his toy, bites his nurse's breast, strangles his canary long before he is able to reason. Cruelty is stamped in animals, in whom... in animals, in whom, as I think I've said, nature's laws are more emphatically to be read than in ourselves. Cruelty exists among savages, so much nearer to nature than civilized men are. Absurd, then, to maintain cruelty as a consequence of depravity. Cruelty is simply the energy in a civilization man is not yet altogether corrupted. Therefore, it is a virtue, not a vice. Now, whether you agree with the Marquis de Sade or not, you have to concede that our want to witness horrors might exceed our better judgment. Whether you're slowing down to have a look at an accident on the side of the road, or typing in a Google search you'll later delete from your history, we've all indulged impulses we're not proud of. What are we getting out of that?
You tell me.
It's hard to say whether we're rationalizing our relationship to cruelty, but we often see violence as part of a narrative, often one of justice. In that light, we might tolerate a lot more violence if we think it's warranted. Maybe not. Maybe you're a pacifist. Maybe you've never seen an episode of 24 and the thought of enhanced interrogation makes you sick. But we're talking movies. Horror movies, where violence is often expected. And in the case of torture porn, maybe even the point. In a post called The 120 Days of Hostel Part 2, a reference to the Marquis de Sade's 120 Days of Sodom, at The Exploding Kinetoscope, Chris Stengel argues that the phrase torture porn is simply a meaningless critical buzzword, quote, a non-position that allows the critic not to engage the work. It's critical name-calling, end quote. He goes on to say, the problem of the day is that phrase, torture porn, is passive-aggressive non-engagement with the film. It makes drastic assumptions that are never backed up, chief among them the implied sexualization of violence, of which Hostel, Wolf Creek, or Saw, or what have you, may or may not be guilty, may complicate, may critique, may even subvert. But the critic never finds out, because who bothers with textual analysis of pornography? And who likes torture? You don't like torture, right?
Speak for yourself.
That's too hard. Too hard. There's something Stephen King wrote in his essay, Why We Crave Horror Movies, that stayed with me. He said, quote, one critic has suggested that if pro football has become the voyeur's version of combat, then the horror movie has become the modern version of the public lynching. End quote. That's a dark thought, but in a weird way, it speaks of the progress our culture has made. It may not be apparent based on the constant influx of bad news and discord, but the world is a lot more civil now than it was 100 years ago. We're making progress, but we haven't totally left behind those violent impulses or the subconscious draw towards seeing justice done. In movies like Saw, the violence is godlike, a test of will designed by Jigsaw to shock its subject back into their humanity and appreciating life. At least that's the note the series begins on. In the Hostel series, we get a close-up look at sadism, distilling down the relationship of exploiter and the exploited.
Are you done yet? When I sat down to take a look at these and we were passing articles back and forth and having different thoughts to look at torture porn, there's so many scholarly articles, journals on torture porn.
It became a go-to for film critics just because it's kind of low-hanging fruit.
Some are better than others, I will definitely say. And some people, anytime someone who's trying to write a scholarly work thinks that they're smarter than the situation, you can get right the fuck out. Like, as soon as you do that, get out. But what I was kind of mostly interested in was, what's the difference between torture porn and ultra violence? Because it seems sort of at face value to a lot of people, or to maybe to people who don't understand maybe the genre, that it's the same thing. But I really don't think it is. I think there's a great difference between it. So I kind of, these are the things I think make torture porn torture porn. However, there are certain exceptions to every rule.
Sure.
And for me, a lot of these are the ones that make you think that Saw might not be torture porn. Because what I expect is nihilism, essentially, from my whoever's doing the torturing. I'm expecting terrorism. I'm expecting physical terrorism and mental terrorism.
Okay.
Of a subject. It's going to be very detail-oriented crime, detail-oriented violence.
In terms of the visuals we're witness to?
Exactly.
Okay.
And even the violence that's being executed to the people. As far as, clearly, we have Jigsaw, which is these very elaborate...
He's become the new archetype.
Yeah, it's very like Bond villain, like walk over there, a shark will eat you in 10 minutes, I'm going to go over here kind of a thing. But it's all very, very detail oriented. And even in something like the basic Wolf Creek, because he is in Wolf Creek, he is a local yokel. But when he creates that head on a stick, it's with surgical precision. Surgical precision.
All
it's
right.
Not an accident that he merely severs her spine and doesn't kill her.
Now, this little procedure is called making a head on a stick. Because once your spine's severed, right? That's what you are, eh? Head on a stick.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm saying, like, very detail-oriented. It's also very hyper-realistic, the visuals that you're getting.
Yeah, I think torture porn kind of, well, it became a thing for any number of reasons, and we'll talk about a lot of them, but this isn't a genre that could have existed in any generation before.
Right. I mean, we do see it in ultraviolence of Cannibal Holocaust, obviously, where it's very real, ultra-realism, but... Now kind of even we watch it and be like, they're sitting down. You know, also in I think torture porn, the situations are always immediate. There's a timeline. It's like now, or it could be 6 hours in the case of Saw, but there is a timeline and that is it. So you're in an immediate situation that needs to be solved or overcome.
I was thinking in terms of the visuals and even the cinematography and its relationship to the violence that... I guess it was something that occurred to me specific to Hostel that it's not all over the place, but like Hostel, the cinematography functions as male gaze oftentimes.
Mm-hmm.
And like sometimes like really
ridiculously
over the top. One of the things that I consider falling under the trope of torture porn is when the camera acts as the male gaze, but for gratuitous violence.
I could see that.
I think those are the moments where, you know, if you do have time to process and think a separate thought, then you might wonder like why am I watching this way? Like this is sadistic to the viewer.
Yes, I could see that. I mean, to some extent though, you have that with French Extremity. You know, you have that rape scene that's going to last probably 3 minutes or more, 9 minutes in one very particular film's case.
Name it Irreversible.
Yeah. There's also a different relationship with sex and torture porn. Before the torture starts, sex is enjoyed and you see it in a positive way. Like, oh, there's naked ladies in my room. Well, in Saw, there's nothing really sexual. I mean, he's having an affair.
Right, but even
that's
then,
about it. It's not really a particularly sexual thing. But in Hostel, you see that. Even in Human Centipede, the girls are very sexualized. Mm-hmm. And it's used in a way that's different than Slasher, where the girls are sexualized and then there's a price to pay for that sexuality.
Right.
this has nothing to do with it. It's like when you said gratuitous violence, I feel like it's actually gratuitous nudity and sex in torture porn. And the violence is, I mean, it's not gratuitous, because when you cut someone's, or when you rip someone's face in half, an explosion's going to happen. Blood's going to go everywhere. It's not really gratuitous. It's factual.
Yeah, but I think the portrayal of... and
just showing it all. You're saying like the overtness of it.
Yeah, and I've got mixed feelings about the movies we're going to talk about, because I think they kind of... they were the dam breaking, but they don't actually exemplify the worst of torture porn. Like those movies, I don't know, more so I think than Saw 1 and Hostel 1.
Right.
The torture porn is more evident in the knockoffs, in the movies that are done less well and with less precision and less thought and consideration. But yeah, I think these movies actually hold back a lot of the violence, and it happens off camera, and our imaginations are left to fill in some of the blanks. Not always. I mean, Hostel particularly shows you exactly what the fuck is up.
Yes, it does. And as Saw works its way forward, I think to compete in the market that it sort of created, it becomes more and more just showing it all.
Yeah, by Saw.
Because who didn't want to see that reverse bear trap work? And we were robbed of it at the beginning. We were robbed. But then we get to see it.
Yeah, no, I was thinking by Saw 3D, the final cut, like they're literally throwing shit at you, the audience.
It's just absurd. It's absurd. So we kind of, we think of torture porn being especially prominent 2004 to 2008. That's your big kind of timeline. And it's kind of kicked off with Saw. And there's a few things that I recognize about these torture films, in that 2004 Saw, the victims are not random. And that's why Saw is a little bit different than kind of everyone else. Passion of the Christ is in 2004. Again, it's a not random victim, and he's a single victim. But it's
a snuff film. Yeah.
It is torture porn in that way.
Yes.
Then we have Hostel, where we have random randos. Wolf Creek in 2005 as well, random. And then Human Centipede kind of taking it to the next level of torture porn, and they're essentially random people in that. But we're not really here to talk about Human Centipede, because it is at the end. I think these movies have such a right to exist, and I think they're such a valid form of art, whether I like them or not, on whether I think they're great films or not. I think that they have such a validity to society and to the world we live in, and to art and to just film. I will defend these films all day long. Whether I like them or not, I'll defend their right to be here.
So we're going to begin proper with Hostel from 2005, written by maybe my least favorite. Maybe Uwe Boll beats him out, but Eli Roth. Written and directed by Eli Roth. This was his follow-up to Cabin Fever after catching the attention of Quentin Tarantino, whose Pulp Fiction makes a cameo in the movie. Starring Jay Hernandez and Derek Richardson, mostly those two, and a lot of Romanian and Czech locals, and a handful of porn stars for the riskier stuff.
And Oli is Icelandic.
Yeah.
He is like a champion handball player or some shit.
I'd read that Eli Roth...
is that true?
Throw off taken by Iceland.
I don't know about the handball.
Stefansson has to come back to help.
Wait. But I guess... yes, handball.
And he scores. So strange. Eli Roth had met him and was like, "You are such a fascinating human being. I'm going to put you in my next movie." And the guy was like, "Yeah, right." And then he did.
All right, Oli!
Hey, I told you, man. I'm the king of the swing.
Oli, who is 10 years older than our other characters.
But you know what? He's like a better actor than Josh. Josh is fucking the worst.
Man, I'm tired, man. I can like barely stand up.
Josh, you want to be a fucking writer? How about some life experience right there in that room?
Whoa! What are we having here?
I said too much! You pay!
I pay, man. Come on!
With cameos by Eli Roth, I think he's smoking a bong in one of the bars they're in that's supposed to be Amsterdam. And also Takashi Miike is one of the dudes on his way out of the torture emporium.
Excuse me. How is it in there?
Be careful.
Why is that?
You could spend all your money in there.
And like I mentioned, Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction makes a small cameo. Here's a brief synopsis for the uninitiated. Three backpackers, the Americans Josh and Paxton and their Icelandic friend Ollie, head to a Slovak city that promises to meet their hedonistic expectations with no idea of the hell that awaits them. I will say off the bat, I watched it. This was my second time watching the film.
Yeah.
I watched it years ago on DVD.
Sure.
And hated it.
Okay. I think I might have seen it in the theater.
Oh, yeah?
Might not be lying about that.
I think maybe at the time I was kind of watching it with a predisposition to dislike anything by Eli Roth. And I still maintain that for the most part. But at the time I was just kind of like, this is not well written, not well executed, kind of shitty. Just, you know, torture porn. Early 2005, I didn't like it. This time around, I got a lot more out of it. You know, I'm still coming to terms with that for myself, but I did like it a lot more. I still think Hostel 2 is a better film.
Yes,
it's far
Hostel
more interesting.
2 is more interesting.
But this, I don't know. I didn't hate Hostel this time around.
I felt like I liked it the first time. I rewatched it for this. I did not care for it.
You went the other way around.
I mean, again, it's like so important. It was one of those, like, Jackson came in and he was like dogging it for something. And I was like, no, it's because of this, this, and this, is blah, blah. And so I had to like stand up for it, which irritates me a little bit. And I will stand up for it. But the acting, the writing, not good. Not good.
No, I think I give this movie a lot of credit for the themes at play. So a few things are happening to sort of build this narrative. By choosing a setting of Eastern Europe after the Yugoslav and Kosovo wars, our protagonists are set to exploit a region of the world where a lot of young men have died and there's a disproportionate number of single women.
So wait, this place is near Bratislava?
Josh, you won't find this hostel in any guidebook. Barcelona. So many Americans, but Slovakia, no one there. There is so much pussy, and because of the war, there are no guys. You go to this hostel, you will have any girl you want. They go crazy for any foreigner.
And so between their goal of having all the sex in Bratislava, Slovakia, an economically disenfranchised nation, they're kind of modeling the exploitation that America's accused of, you know, committing upon the rest of the world.
Yeah, kind of over Amsterdam, you know, way too many Americans.
Yeah, but Ollie's got a friend with the flat in Barcelona, and he's supposed to hook us up with some hot ass centimeters.
Maybe, you know, 19-year-olds would actually say some of these things, but I thought it was really funny that the characters, I think it's Paxton specifically, has a bug up his ass about running into Americans while they're there overseas.
Yeah.
And the irony is that, like, when people complain about Americans traveling abroad, it's that they're loud and obnoxious, and that's what our main characters are. So they're looking around at other Americans,
yes,
being loud and obnoxious, and they're like, ugh.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, motherfucker, look in a mirror.
But so they're there. And so then we get our first kind of glimpse of what we're in for, which is naked roommate ladies.
Oh, sorry. Oh my God.
It's okay. The room is yours. We're going to the spa.
Women in Slovakia just don't wear shirts. And they're all very, very good looking.
They're not so caught up. They're not hung up on all the puritanical nonsense
they're
that we are.
They're very thin and beautiful and booby. Now, from my Eastern European family, of which there's not very much left, but I've seen pictures and they don't look anything like that. That is the opposite of what they look like.
For that reason, Eli Roth kind of strikes me as someone who thinks back at like 80s slashers and maybe like late 70s and like misses the boobs. Like, hey, he's one of those guys who complains like, hey, horror movies used to have boobs in them.
Where'd just all the boobs go,
he says. Random sex and, you know, teen shenanigans and nudity and why, let's throw some of that back in the movies. And like, that's not what made those movies good, man.
Like, that wasn't the point.
No, but I think he thinks it is kind of part of the point. And for the formula that he's in 2005 in Hostel, that he's helping to create, whether he knew it or not, that does become the formula.
With Cabin Fever, I was lucky enough to get to go around touring at these film festivals, and I started seeing movies that never come to America. And I was exposed to directors like Takashi Miike, who did Audition and Ichi the Killer, and films coming out of South Korea like Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance. And I just thought, oh my God, what the hell is going on in these Asian countries that they are making the movies this violent? And what I saw was that American movies try to play it safe. American horror movies. They don't want to offend people. And the kind of the directors like Miike understand that what makes a great horror movie is that it lives in that danger zone, that dangerous territory. And you harkens back to kind of Italian cinema in the 70s, films like Cannibal Holocaust or Pasolini's Salo, where they're making movies that are so violent, but they're not trying to please everybody. They're not for everybody. They're for a very specific audience. They're like, this is a sick movie. If you don't like it, stay the hell away from it. And I just felt like nobody was doing anything like that in America. So that's what I wanted to do. And I also like the fact that the Asian films aren't really pure. They're not exactly pure horror movies. It's not like The Grudge or The Ring. Like, there's a wave of these ultra-violent films that are much more horrific than scary. You know, it's about, like, real people doing real things, and they're just horrifying and disturbing. And that's the type of film I really wanted to make.
What ends up happening to our two guys is not because they had sex with those girls.
Right.
It has nothing to do with it. They're doing drugs. They're having sex. There is no moral, like in your slasher films where it's a morality kind of tale.
Right,
like, don't
right.
do that or you're going to get killed. These guys are just doing whatever they want. It is pure maleness.
Yeah. You had mentioned before the sort of correlation between nihilism and torture porn. Mm-hmm. There's the creepy European guy on the train who sits down with the group and starts getting like, well, I mean, he touches the dude's leg and he's kind of like creepily flirty. And,
yeah.
But he's recognizing that like these American boys are like on their European rumspringa. They are
right,
exploiting
right.
the continent. And he goes like,
what? Slovakia. You will like it. Casino. Girls. You can pay to do anything. Anything.
And it's like this land of candy.
Yeah,
streets
and at
are
no point
with cheese.
Does it occur to them that like there is a price to be paid for, you know, excess.
Right.
In this case. And there's certainly
and there's not
repercussions. Well, I mean,
that has nothing to do with it. Everyone's just doing their own thing.
So before we ever arrive at the hostel proper, our guys are in Amsterdam. They're smoking everything. They're
right.
nailing all the prostitutes. That's their jam. When a creepy, cold-sword European guy tells them that, like, you guys are having fun, right? You want to know where the best fun is? Like, they're not having enough sex. Like, there's
no,
always
there
more
could be
sex
more.
To be had. I forgot what it's like to be 19.
I found, though, even this movie, it's in 2005. It still feels very super dated, like it was, like, set in 1995.
I think that's the Eastern European setting.
Mm-hmm.
I think Romania and the Czech Republic became hubs of, like, you know, like, medium-sized filmmaking.
Yeah.
Where
those films always film, like, 10 years behind.
Yeah. I've watched, and this is a random bit of non sequitur, but I think at this point I might have seen all of the Return of the Living Dead series.
Oh, those are all filmed over there and dubbed and
yeah,
weird.
Those yeah. all found a home in Eastern Europe for production.
And it's like, oh, this is filmed in 2012 and a guy's wearing JNCOs. This is the best thing ever. So they go to this crazy new land of awesomeness and boobs and stuff, and suddenly Ollie doesn't make it back. Ollie, the best character in the whole fucking movie.
Well, it's funny, the best fucking character. That kind of is his role, is to yeah. nail any and all.
He's the crazy guy. He's the wild Icelandic guy.
He's 10 years too old, and I think they tried to give him a little bit of background by saying, like, hey, he's a dad. He's got a daughter back home. Never mind he's nailing everything that's not
right.
nailed down. But in any case, yeah, when he goes missing, then the kind of tone of I Brought His Lava, I think that's what it's supposed to be, it sours, at which point, like, the townspeople, and that was the point that I might have liked this movie the most, when it does have the tone of, like, Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None.
Right.
It, a little bit of, like, Wicker Man, of, like, the townspeople know what's up, and they are giving you knowing glances.
Yeah, exactly.
And our guys are, you know, I think at that point they start to get a little suspicious. Certainly the photos that are texted to them
are strange.
A pretty poor excuse for a con job.
Well, and also Ollie doesn't go missing by himself. There are two Japanese tourists and one of them is now missing. And she's like, hey, my friend is missing. And because they were like, oh, our friend is missing. And he's like, he literally says,
what, they left? Like, together?
That doesn't make any sense. Ollie doesn't even like Asian girls. I mean, no offense, but when did she send this to you?
That's all the evidence I needed.
Also, if I was the other girl, I'd be like, what the fuck does that mean? Like, fuck you.
Yeah, so those moments I did like, when there is an air of suspicion, but again, our guys are so one-track minded that they hang around and it keeps going and escalating.
And we see our first bit of violence, but it's literally like 30 minutes into the film before we actually see violence. It's a toe cutting.
It's kind of sex violence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a toe cutting, which we don't see. It's alluded to. And then it cuts over to the other tourists clipping her toenails.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Which I thought, don't clip your toenails in the common room, you savage.
Yeah. I mean, have you ever stayed in a hostel?
No, of course not.
I have a hard time imagining you staying in a hostel.
Could you imagine?
Okay, so I've stayed in a handful. They're gross. They're pretty gross. Common areas aren't really given the respect. The common area should be given.
Clipping your toenails in the common area? I don't even clip my toenails in my common living room area.
Where do you go to the bathroom to do it?
Yes, of course.
All right, that's a little weird. It is your home. Give yourself a break.
My gift to you, man.
Thanks, man.
The pain to go into a room to do whatever you want to someone isn't exactly a turnout.
How are you going to get over your chick if you don't
pay? So jumping ahead, and not to give spoilers just yet, but our first full-on torture scene... Mm-hmm. Familiar faces, some drill play. I'm trying to think. I guess I've seen it in movies since, but was
like
that novel
time,
at the time?
The first time I think I ever saw like a drill being used in a torturous way was probably in Shallow Grave.
I don't have a
vivid
memory.
We don't get a full drilling, but it's like a thread of drilling and then a little baby bit of drilling. A little bit of drilling going on.
Maybe just the skin, not so much the bone.
Just the tip, you might say. Maybe Eli Roth might say that.
these movies do escalate.
Yes.
But this movie at least holds a little back. And so there is a pretty... Well, we can say it's an Achilles tendon or two, but that they happen off camera and in the moment we are left to kind of presume what's happening.
Right. All we don't really get
is the pained face of our character.
Yeah, it could be anything.
And wow.
Then when you see it, you see it. It cannot be anything else once you see it.
The sadist in that room, like, that wasn't his first time. Well, I guess it wasn't because he... demos the tattoo.
Right.
And so we know he's indoctrinated. He knows what he's expecting.
Yep.
And he goes into that torture room like a fucking professional.
Oh, yeah. To me, like, that really defines this movement of films, is that the premise, the scene, but that particular scene where he says, you can get away. Go ahead. I will unchain you. If you just,
that's
all
so
you got to
do
is walk out, I'll leave the door wide open.
Oh, God.
And then, nope, that was J/K.
Yeah, when, well.
And to me, that's torture porn.
I thought about
in
it.
A nutshell.
So I've got, and I agree with you, and it certainly speaks to the nihilism. That is like blind sadism. One of my picadillos, and I've complained about it on the show a lot, is anytime someone's feet are fucked with by something low to the ground, maybe it goes back to, like, I don't know, the fear of, like, high school injuries and at times, and knowing that an Achilles tendon injury takes forever to heal, and sometimes you might not even fully come back from that. Well, and so I take it really seriously when someone starts angling down there.
And also, there's always that fear, like a monster's going to come out even and just grab you by your ankles.
Yeah.
That when you're in water and you can't see the bottom.
Why you keep storage under your bed.
This is why I do that. But, you know, while you're, if you're in water and something brushes up against the bottom of your legs, is there something about people wanting to be very protective of that area of your ankle?
Yeah.
And that's because you fucking need it to escape.
Yeah, so I guess the other pet peeve, which it comes not long after, but is when anybody fucks with hands.
Yeah.
So in this scene kind of wraps up with that really sadistic, like, you're free if you can get out. And we see that doesn't pan out.
No.
But so like the next instance, it's almost like a torture blooper when dude's hands come off.
Yes.
Well, parts.
Yeah, that was one where when I rewatched it, I was like, whoa, didn't see that coming. It was so quick.
Yeah.
That was quick. There was no lead up to it, which Eli Roth, you know, is playing with you with all the everything, the toe cutting. It's just a little BB right there, like just a little bit. And then we get, you know, the Achilles, and that's fucking gross. And then the hand situation is just like no easing you in. It's just like, boom, right in.
It's almost like a horror whoopsie.
Yeah.
Like there's no, it's certainly not the culmination of that scene. If anything, I actually give him a lot of credit for like, that is the severity of a chainsaw.
Right.
It is an imprecise and severe tool when it's used against a human being. And like, yeah, like you said, it just kind of boop. Oh, now you're missing.
Yeah.
You're missing stuff.
And you go, I didn't see that one coming for that.
Neither did he. But a good way to get out of handcuffs.
Oh,
if,
it's
if
true.
You've got
it's
a
true.
Lot less hand.
It's true. Plus that blood is super slippery. I would have like lubed up my other hand too to get out. I wouldn't have honestly thought like that. I would have been freaking out. But also, did you notice like the, okay, I don't know. Maybe it's just me. I'm in a situation like this, might lose some appendages. I'm not going to go after them. I'm going to say probably they're gone and I should go now.
That I thought was a little, like, I think that might read true just for someone in shock that you're not processing. You're just kind of like,
I should get all my things.
I don't want to leave anything behind.
I must have all my things.
This is the one, like, decidedly non-American reaction. It's just kind of like, oh, let me clean up after myself.
Yeah, no, I would be
leave
like,
no trace.
Leave those there because they're not going to glue back on. But then he makes a completely different decision later on when it's involving someone else's parts. And he's like, see you later, that.
Okay, so we'll get there. But so the torturer who does decide on the chainsaw. It is our on camera. I mean, are we counting the first one? We don't really get any visual details for the first kill. We just get the aftermath. So I guess technically the chainsaw attack is our third predator. And that guy I loved as far as like character actors and these little, you know, the idea that like there are no small roles, just, small
he's a good
actors.
One.
That he doesn't speak except through body language. And so he kind of, I'm trying to think as far as like, what is he divulging in his behavior? He is a little noncommittal. Maybe it's not his first time. Maybe his first time went a little too fast and he wants to draw this one out. And
right.
So he's kind of getting selective about what tools he uses and how, but he's nervous and he's a little fidgety.
He's not Julian Richings, but doesn't he remind you of
Julian Richings? Yeah, I
can
see
Cube.
Him. Yeah. Julian Richings is a very like lanky guy. Our little torturer, I think, based on his reaction, well, he at least speaks German. I don't know where he's from.
Right.
But that he's like wiry and nervous.
Yeah.
And he's not completely jaded. You get the impression that like the previous torturer, you could say whatever you wanted to that guy. There's nothing that would give him pause.
Right.
This newer twitchy guy is nervous enough that he's influenced.
Yeah.
And that I thought was, that was a pretty compelling moment. And then he decides like, chainsaw.
Yeah.
Let's wrap this up.
He's like, this'll do. And let me tell you, when a chainsaw comes out, no good's ever going to come from it for anyone.
No, it's a pretty good, almost like Texas Chainsaw style reveal that you hear it before you see it.
Oh yeah,
that was good. I like that.
Yeah.
The buildup of nervousness in that one particular scene is great. I'm not, you know, torture porn is certainly not my go to genre.
No.
I don't know. I don't particularly enjoy it. But that scene was well orchestrated.
There's something just fun to it, you know, and it's about torture porn. It's like one of those films you put on, you know, while there's a party going on or something, because it's just silly and gratuitous.
Well, maybe Hostel,
because
it's also boobs. It's boobs,
and violence. And so you don't really even need to go know what's going on. I think one of the things versus like ultra violence or even extremity is that torture porn exists in tableau, and the violence is storyboarded, and the story is built around these violent imaginings.
Mm-hmm.
So they said, I kind of want to see this happen with the chainsaw. And then the story is built to make that scene happen. And they said, I found this effect on the Achilles. I want to do this. And the story is built around that. It's not that the violence comes organically to the story. I think they said this is going to be a great scene, and each one of those violent scenes could be a tiny, tiny violent film in itself.
I see that, but I do think,
I mean, it makes
it's organic to
movie,
the story. Yeah,
but I think they said, I want to see this, like just like Human Centipede. They're like, I want to see this. Now let's create a backstory of the person who would think this, and especially when you get into Saw and some of those devices. It's literally they came up with that device, and how can we make this device go?
Right, right.
You know?
Yeah. I think Hostel 2 explores interesting territory from that perspective in terms of the...
I want to see this.
Yeah, and fleshing out the kind of person who does want to see that.
Right.
The kind of person who's like doing that, not just wanting to see it, but like, I want to be the man behind the chainsaw.
I'll bring my friend.
Yeah. I guess we're not really going too deep into Hostel 2, but that it does... I think the characters are far more interesting in Hostel 2.
I love Roger Bart. The idea of Roger Bart, though, Tony Award winner Roger Bart, being this like crazy, mad guy who's going to go with his friend to go kill some people is the most bizarre thing to me. Like, makes no sense knowing the singing, dancing Roger Bart. I was like, this is Snoopy right here? No way.
So in differentiating between ultraviolence and torture porn, I'm thinking to like you, the aforementioned like New French Extremity mm-hmm. films, and how those are described as not necessarily violent films. They are. But more so films about violence.
Yes.
New French Extremity, I will give them the credit that they're kind of broader minded. When they talk about violence, they're often talking about like religious violence in the case of Martyrs.
Mm-hmm.
Sexual violence, irreversible. There are gender dynamics at play in High Tension. There's toxic masculinity.
In Calvaire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so they explore the domain of violence through, you know, through violent acts, but it becomes more about the relationship and the viewer and what you're coming into the movie with. Whereas like Hostel, there's not that much depth to it.
No.
There's not greater commentary in there.
However, you watch that film and you think about it being in 2005, and really the style, the look, the color, the way the violence, the effects are done, it really did start something.
Oh, yeah.
Because you wouldn't have had some of the TCMs after that, the Wrong Turn, the things where mm-hmm. it just like lived in this look. It's a very specific look.
Yeah, and we'll talk about it more in depth in terms of Saw, but this generation of horror movies that were kind of like... not micro budget, but pretty close.
Yeah.
And they kind of turn filth into an aesthetic.
Yeah.
So that approach, I think it's partly necessity becoming the mother of invention, that these are not high budget films. You know, the cinematographers are kind of not the greatest of all. And the limited budget kind of means that they, you know, simplify rooms, and right. there's, you know, you're not going to get like gothic horror and these, you know, sort of
Literally in Hostel, there's cardboard facades on the building.
Right.
It's disgusting.
That did kind of open the floodgates for these low-budget torture, you know, torture kind of movies.
Low-budget, young people having fun, having sex, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it became a huge moneymaker.
You get less interesting villains when motive becomes incidental, to
right.
quote Scream. So, on that note, let's go a year before Hostel to 2004's Saw.
So Saw, even before we get to the synopsis, it's 2004. This was, to me, what I still think of as the golden age of Lionsgate, where Lionsgate used to have these just amazing fucking movies. And you knew with Lionsgate, it was either going to be amazing, like amazing, blow your mind, or it was going to be the worst thing you ever saw.
Right. And they have low budgets in common.
Yes. And you never knew what you were going to get. And those were like great days of Lionsgate, which doesn't exist anymore, which is very sad because it became like what? Ghost, part of Ghost House or something.
Oh, did they? Did they merge? Is that
why? But there's something so like lovely about Saw from the very beginning that reminds me of Cube. Like visually,
okay.
reminds me of, we got this room. It's dingy, and it's very Cube to me.
It's kind of mission oriented.
Yeah. So then, to me, those kind of films eventually then become what Circle becomes. Or okay.
not a lot of people have seen Circle, but
they probably should.
I guess it's on Netflix. It's that one's a little tough to describe in a nutshell.
Those are those films, though. They have this feeling behind them. And Saw to me was one of the first films I think saw that had that indie horror feel. So the IMDb synopsis is very succinct, I suppose, for Saw. Two strangers who awaken in a room with no recollection of how they got there soon discover they're pawns in a deadly game perpetrated by a notorious serial killer. Directed by James Wan, and I mean, this is the first James Wan, like,
yeah,
golden, where it's like the Midas touch kind of thing.
Straight out of film school.
Yeah. Written by Lee Whannell, who then goes on to write all the other ones, who does Insidious, who does Cooties, I mean, everything.
He just directed Upgrade. That's in the theaters now. That's supposed to be pretty good. I like the look of the trailer. It looks novel.
Well, there you go. And also James Wan helped to write it.
So we finally realized we're going to have to make a film that we're going to pay for it ourselves. We can probably maybe save up $10,000. What's a story that you could shoot for $10,000, two people in one room? And we spent a long time trying to come up with a... I think the smaller the confines, the better the idea has to be. Like, the more there are... Like, Paranormal Activity, it's set in this bedroom, but the idea is so strong. It's like a couple filming themselves, shooting themselves on video while they sleep. Like, and even back then, we were really pushing ourselves to come up with this hook. And it took, like, the best part of a year, like, just pitching each other ideas. No, that's not good enough. That's not good enough. And to answer your question, I remember the day that James called and he kind of pitched me this vague idea. He's like, okay, two guys wake up in this bathroom and there's a dead body in the middle. And they don't know how they got in the room. And at the end, and it's... and...
Yep.
And
I'm like, I think I have the
that's
seed.
That's good. I mean, like,
I was like, I think I had the seed of an idea. I'm not quite sure what it could be, but I think it could be really cool. And so Lee's like, okay. He hangs up. Like half an hour later, he calls me back and goes, I think the title should be called Saw.
I love Cary Elwes. He stars in this film.
I was
going to
ask you if, I mean, ever since The Princess Bride, he holds a special place in a lot of people's hearts.
And it's always good to see him in the not X-Files Cary Elwes, because I would say that's not the best Cary Elwes. And then even in Seinfeld, he's on there for a little while. He's not the best Cary Elwes. Like, he's like kind of a jerk.
I don't remember Cary Elwes in
Seinfeld.
He's
like married to somebody, and Elaine's trying to get with him, and Jerry's trying to get with the other one. Oh, he's married to Deborah Messing in Seinfeld.
Oh.
The first marriage that Deborah Messing has.
Okay, they're trying to break them up?
Yes. So this, though, was like, I think, the first, like, where Cary always is looking pretty handsome, even though he's all beaten up. And you're, like, thinking of him like, yeah, there's Cary always from Princess Bride.
I think this was a little bit of a resurgence, right? He was in Kiss the Girls. And
oh, yeah, he was.
Then he was in this. And then he was in a later Saw movie that I don't remember which one. Maybe 5? Maybe 6?
He was in Robin Hood, Men in Tights.
Well, yeah.
And why should the people listen to you?
Because, unlike some other Robin Hoods, I can speak with an English accent.
Filling out the rest of the cast is Danny.
Who cares about the rest of the cast?
Mindy's just looking at his IMDb.
I'm just looking to see.
Filling out the cast is Danny Glover, who I've loved since Lethal Weapon, and I was a little kid, and I love his activism. I love Danny Glover. I'm also too old for this shit.
I oftentimes am, too.
Lee Whannell, in addition to writing, is Cary Elwes' scene partner.
Yes.
We've got Shawnee Smith in a couple of scenes.
Oh, yeah.
She comes back strong in the next one, but loved her since the Blob remake in 88. Monica Potter's got a smaller role as Cary Elwes' suffering
good in
wife.
This.
I don't think James Wan... This was right out of film school.
He didn't know what to
He's
do.
He's not a very good actor's director.
No.
In this. There are a number of scenes in the second act that are hard to sit through.
Yes.
On account of the bad acting.
There is a scene that's very similar to what I only complain about Sunshine. The only complaint I have is when the guy's freezing to death and it's like, and his teeth are chattering and it's just absurd.
Yeah, that's Captain America
you're
talking about.
Yeah, I don't like that scene. I think it's terribly acted and... There is a character who does a scene that's very similar
to that. Listen to me. I've frozen to death. I know what that
looks
like.
Towards the end. And he's not freezing to death in this scene, but it's also very like, okay, you got to go. I get it. Go. And then he keeps explaining why he's got to go.
We've got Dina Meyer. She comes back in bigger in 2 and 3. I don't remember exactly, but we've also got Ken Leong. And from Lost, Michael Emerson playing Zep.
Yep, Zep. Don't.
It's such
about
a rude
Zep.
Nickname. I felt bad for his character.
Isn't he the pinhead, Zep?
Zippy the
oh,
pinhead.
Oh, that's right.
So we've done an Escape the Room night out.
Yes, we did.
Ours was a futuristic kind of Blade Runner sci-fi themed one, but I was thinking about those didn't exist 15 years ago.
No.
The whole Escape the Room industry. I think they owe a check to Lee Whannell and James Wan. I think they invented the idea with Saw.
Maybe Cube could take some of that money.
That's fair. There was...
It's literally a cube.
Well, right, but...
And then later a Tesseract,
there
but
was
it's
problem
a cube.
Solving involved just in terms of like judging the different rooms and how they would kill you.
Literally, there's... fictional mathematics that are
but
really,
really
important.
All it took to get well okay I guess as far as like if you're thinking of Cube as the entire structure pre-Tesseract
yes
there was like a confined space that you could escape it wasn't all apparent to you at the one moment but
obviously Cube so Zero
Cube,
Hypercube
Cube
is
deserves,
a whole different thing.
Okay yeah I'll go with that I think Saw was definitely you know, a public
more
movement
famous.
Where, sure. yeah, Cube doesn't really get the respect it deserves, although it did make it to our top 25 all time.
Cube is good, man.
Oh, this is, I'm really immature, and I laughed really hard when Cary Elwes has to throw the microcassette recorder to Lee Whannell across the room.
Why doesn't he know how to throw?
He throws like a toddler.
He is very fancy. His family is very fancy. And
does he?
It's
comes
literally
money?
How I would expect. Very fancy. It's how I would expect maybe... those princes in England to throw things. I assume probably very similarly.
You've got a history of family anemia. Like you throw, like you're always throwing with the wrong hand.
Yes, that's exactly.
Yeah.
It was like, no, you're going to be left-handed today. Because that's how I throw with my left hand.
We're going to have to work together if we want to get out of here. Now just throw it to me.
I'm not going to risk breaking it. You throw me your tape.
Okay, so question for you. it weighed upon me more and more as the movie plays out. But if you were in their situation and you woke up chained in that room, how quickly would you acclimate to an utterly disgusting room? Also, keep in mind you're barefoot, which makes it way worse.
I think I would acclimate really well because
really,
I do really good in terrible situations. Okay. I am really adept to like getting my shit together if I have to.
Okay, so you wouldn't like just be continually skeeved out.
No, in a situation you want to be with me because I can shut that shit down and focus on the task. It's my secret power.
Okay, all right. I thought I might have a problem with it.
You just cry.
Yes.
That's okay. That's why people like me come in and slap you. But
stop being hysterical. In our Patreon episode, we just talked pretty extensively about Gaslight, the second of those films, and the concept and the hysteria and the Victorian, you know, heavens to Betsy frenzy that that women are portrayed as working
that
up.
Would
that
be
would
you.
Be me.
That
yeah.
would be you.
Just need a good
no,
whack
I
to the face.
I'm really, really good at getting my shit together when I need to. Which is funny because in other situations where I don't necessarily need to, I'll be hysterical.
Hysterical crying. Just hope you're on the streets of New York where no one will know or care.
My favorite thing to do.
Another note, I had completely forgotten about the subplot where Jigsaw frames Carrie Elwes as Jigsaw.
Yeah.
It's a minor point. It's mostly to like get him into the police precinct where he can sort of indirectly monitor someone else's testimony. Not testimony,
so,
but...
there's a lot of things that don't make sense. It's like Jigsaw, later we know certain things about Jigsaw later on in the Saw films, but it's like he's also suffering from a little bit of dementia because he kind of forgets what the fuck's going on.
Yeah.
There's like an angry old
there's
man.
A lot of incongruities and nonsensical stuff mm-hmm. that might not occur to you with the first viewing because the movie does have momentum. And I will say that like...
Oh, I love this movie.
The last, what, the last 5 minutes of the movie yeah. build to a beautiful crescendo.
Yeah.
But if you are taking your time and sort of picking it apart, you will find plenty to criticize. And like I said, the goofs page on IMDb is pretty extensive. So if you want to get that nerdy, I suggest you read it. It's no fun though. It's
no.
just kind of chipping away at something you might like. But yeah, I don't know. This time around, I did have some qualms with that kind of stuff.
Sure, sure. There's always things because... Right out of the gate, we're just exposed to, like, all the rules are bullshit. And he's such a rules-based serial killer.
Okay, so that's something that I had been coming to terms with because my recollection was a lot more generous to this movie.
Yes.
My memory was that all the devices of torture and punishment were... far better characterized with the individuals that they were put upon.
You thought it was like Seven, sort of.
I did, a little bit.
It's because of the guy in the cage, because that's great.
Hello, Paul. You are a perfectly healthy, sane, middle-class male. Yet last month, you ran a straight razor across your wrist. Did you cut yourself because you truly wanted to die, or did you just want some attention? Tonight, you'll show me. The irony is that if you want to die, you just have to stay where you are. But if you want to live, you'll have to cut yourself again. Find a path through the razor wire to the door. But hurry. At 3 o'clock, that door will lock.
That's one of them.
And this is what I'm talking about, the tableau. Guy in the cage.
Works in moments. Yeah.
Stomach grab.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Right, but okay, so that specifically, we can kind of talk about that because Shawnee Smith is in the second movie. We know that she survives this film. She is Jigsaw's best case scenario as far as like execution of plan
right.
and the fallout of gratitude. She is a junkie who Jigsaw puts in the reverse bear trap.
There is only one key open the device. It's in the stomach of your dead cellmate. Look around, Amanda. Know that I'm not lying. You better hurry up. Live or die. Make your choice.
Except, what does that have to do with being a junkie and taking your, like prizing your own life?
Because then she appreciates her life.
Yeah, but do you have to kill somebody to do that? Like, it seems.
Well, then the other thing is
unpoetic.
That guy, the guy who, firstly, they told her, or Jigsaw tells her, oh, that guy's dead, so it doesn't matter, go dig. And then she discovers.
Jigsaw's got a little bit of a sense of humor.
Yeah, but then
because
she discovers.
Because he wrote a giant question mark on the guy's stomach with the point being his
X
belly button.
Marks the spot. Stupid. And then, but then she like discovers, oh, he's actually not dead. Then she kills him anyway. But then what about that guy? That guy, he never got a chance to get out of this. So
no.
Who the fuck is that guy?
That guy was Jigsaw's tax man. Someone just completely disposable, unredeemed.
But
maybe everything he failed
is supposed
another
to be
test.
Redemption.
Maybe that guy, instead of getting killed, was just like anesthetized and he wakes up in that room with a key in his stomach.
I don't think Jigsaw like puts two vignettes together.
Maybe that guy's torture was like, if you don't do this thing, you're going to have to swallow a key. And he lost and he swallowed a key and then he was knocked out. And then he wakes up in that room and he's just like, your death was inevitable. It was just held off into this moment where a junkie's going to
so
cut
like
into you.
So he's like farming this guy essentially.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah.
That's but, too much forethought. I don't think Jigsaw has a forethought.
Yeah, no. That's my memory was that these torture devices were more poignant, that there was a whole story for the characters that they were attached to.
Because the second
really
one's
much.
Like that. Much
yeah.
more.
Yeah. It works. Yeah, I think that, I don't know, maybe that's more time or money. Who knows? But in this case, Shawnee Smith, in kind of the shock of that scene, she's not bitter, she's not angry.
Right.
She is traumatized, but she's come through.
He held me.
And
yes.
when she announces that, it is kind of a chilling moment. It kind of
yeah,
throws you off
like,
that
what
like
the
you're
fuck?
Grateful for the horrifying experience you just went through. Okay. And then in my head, I cut to a scene where Jigsaw is in his workshop and he's just like, if I could get through to just one person, it'll all be worth it.
He's got that like poster of that cat that says, hang in there.
He's got a very like Calvinist aesthetic. He's just like, I just got to keep working harder. I just got to keep working harder.
Just hang in there, Jigsaw. You can do this.
So we talked about the like practically micro budget associated with this. So Lee Whannell and James Wan made the short film version of Saw. They built the puppet out of a standing, you know, puppet, turned it into the nightmare creature it is now, and made that short film to sort of get funding for a feature film version of Saw, for which they were given $1.2 million, a whopping $1.2 million. And they did turn that aesthetic into a functioning thing that carried through all the movies. And this is like, I looked at the budgets of these movies. Saw one, $1.2 million.
Right.
By the end of seven sequels, they had gone as far as putting $20 million into Saw 3D. But then earlier this year, Jigsaw was only made for $10 million.
Only $10 million. Only.
But the returns are huge.
It's insane.
Yeah, the first movie, so $1.2 million turns into a worldwide gross of $103 million, almost $104 million internationally. And that's why there are seven of these fucking movies.
Right.
Like, they are cheap to make. And little by little, they would remove named actors.
Yes.
They would.
And then there was that one that I complained about. It was the last one I watched, which was like five, maybe.
That's
where the two
right.
guys looked exactly the same and I couldn't tell them apart.
Right. There's a guy introduced in four.
Right.
Who comes
and then he
back
comes
in
back.
Five,
and then there's
and they
some
pair
other
him
guy.
Off with another brunette guy
they
who's
look alike.
Bloated face. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know. I could not tell you what was going on because I didn't know the difference between the two actors.
Yeah, at that point, they were just kind of like throwing shit into an established framework.
But where do they find these two? Just put a wig on one of them or dye his hair blonde. I didn't know. They had to have been like James or who. I don't know who was directing it. James Wan doesn't direct those.
No, Darren Lynn Bousman directed.
Maybe
what,
he
two
suffers from
five?
That thing where he thinks everyone looks alike anyway.
Oh, face blindness?
Yeah, and he's like, oh, I'm sure they look different. I just don't know the difference. It's like, no one can tell those two people apart.
They do look very similar, and they're both law enforcement officers, so like, yeah, a little differentiation might be useful. So we've kind of talked about the filthy aesthetic and the cinematography. I don't think it's an accident. Like, it does kind of feel like Mark Romanek's music videos for Nine Inch Nails. It feels a little bit like Closer.
Yeah.
But like poor man's version
Very
of that.
Very industrial.
It's like more dirt. We'll make up the budget with dirt. We'll just
slime,
rub it
dirt,
in the corners.
Whatever.
Toilets. All sorts of awful crap in toilets that we're going to have our actors dig around in. But yeah, I don't know. Every time I think of Mark Romanek and Nine Inch Nails, like I wish he made more films. Like I think the last thing I saw of his was 24 Hour Photo.
What I thought was kind of funny. What I thought was kind of funny was saw it happens in Hostel, and again I always go back to Cube because for a tiny budget film I think of Cube a great deal. Mm-hmm. But the first ones are filthy dirty. And then the second ones are clean and shiny.
They spend a lot more time outside of the rooms.
Yeah.
The other movies.
But and then everything's cleaner. And then as it goes on, it gets more and more clean.
Yeah.
Because think of the Hostel 2. The operating rooms in Hostel 2 are clean.
Yeah. And there's the...
they're completely different.
The Lady Bathory scene.
Yeah.
That was... Yeah, I mean, that
looks
like...
Everything's white and shiny. Yeah. So it's kind of... And Saw gets like... cleaner as it goes on, except for then it just gets ridiculous.
So in addition to the cinematography kind of working with what it has and the set design, a lot should be said about the editing style. It's definitely taking a page from, and again, like early 2000s, the like MTV music video, mm-hmm. fast cuts. A lot of it was just kind of them trying to make up time. All the use of like flash still images, like they didn't have a lot of B-roll. Like there wasn't a lot of establishing shots. A lot of that stuff like just wasn't time for it. This was an 18-day shoot on a million-dollar budget. Yeah.
It kind of reminds me. Some of it's bad though.
Yeah.
It's like bad.
Yeah, it starts to call attention to itself.
There's some really bad stuff, but it reminded me of Alex Proyas.
Of
that
Dark World,
style.
Dark
yeah.
Dark City and The Crow, right? That's him?
Yeah, Dark City.
Gods of Egypt. I forgot. That was so mean that they made him make Gods of Egypt and then they put
him
in director's jail because that movie was a flashy turd.
Because you know what was his greatest thing, though, is this film, this Australian film called Garage Days, where he's allowed to use that kind of quick edit or fast movement with a real like human story behind it. And like that's what it reminds me of, the way that Saw is... It's like it's trying to be like this. They're like, I saw this on a movie one time.
Yeah.
Let's speed up this car scene that has nothing to do with anything.
Let's spin around a single figure in the middle of a room.
Right. No reason. We haven't done it before. We're not going to do it again. We're just going to take our little time around.
Yeah, so a lot of that, Kevin Grutert should get the credit for. He edited just about all the Saw films. He edited 1 through 5. And directed Saw 6 and Saw 3D, the final chapter.
Wow.
So, like, it kind of makes sense to hire someone who's been with the series that long, is familiar with the aesthetic, the pacing, all that stuff.
Except for the other Saw films don't look like this first Saw, really, to me.
You don't think so? I think they certainly open up, but I think that's kind of a budget thing where all of a sudden they've got more territory to explore. So part of making do with a tiny budget are shots that kind of call attention to themselves. I think they work because the pacing is so fast that you don't really second guess like the process shots of the cars with a little bit of smoke blowing by them. But
there
like,
is literally a still of Danny Glover and then the car rolls by and it comes across the screen. It's like a really slow star swipe, but it's a car swipe.
I don't remember that.
It's terrible.
I did notice that in Danny Glover's, like, junkie den shooting gallery investigation hub,
so bizarre.
There's a reel-to-reel recorder in the corner that,
who,
like,
has these things?
That doesn't apply to anything in this film. Like, for starters, Jigsaw would leave the micro cassettes.
Right.
Like, those are your standard cassette, just smaller. Doesn't fit on a reel-to-reel.
No, what are you doing with that?
Yeah, no, it was just kind
He's
of a set
sinister.
Decorators.
He doesn't know it yet.
He doesn't want us to cut through our chains. He wants us to cut through our feet.
So the movie being named Saw, sure. You know, it's a double, if not triple entendre in terms of, you know, yes, it is a device of murder, although no saws in this movie.
There are.
Are there?
Bone saws. Yeah. Because.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. Right. It's their opportunity to escape. Okay, but. The other reference is to that of the Observer, and
right.
Jigsaw has built this scenario around the experience of watching this morality play play out.
While he's simultaneously punishing a voyeur. Right. He's being a voyeur and making someone else also be a voyeur.
Yeah, that was the
but
other
he's very mad at voyeurs.
My memory of this was that Jigsaw was not a humanitarian, obviously, but more high-minded in his efforts.
He's
but
not he's, Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah, no, he's really just kind of, he's like a soft-spoken maniac with a tool shed. Like,
yes.
there's not all that much depth beyond,
it's not
like,
even very clever.
Let's make these people's lives really hard for a short period of time and hope they come out better people.
I mean, it's literally, he said, I have this imagination where I want all this razor wire in this thing. And I'm going to put someone in there. Who shall I choose? Eeny, meeny, you get in there.
Well, do you think he worked backwards or he would like start on
much like James Wan. Yeah, I think he worked backwards.
So speaking to the frenetic pacing, the energy, someone who deserves a lot of the credit and was working on a real short timeline was Charlie Clauser, the musician we talked about his work in the previous episodes when we talked about music, but he's a composer formerly of like the Nine Inch Nails camp,
right.
Who works fast, kind of designs soundscapes and, you know, the elements reminiscent of Nine Inch Nails aesthetics. Yeah, I don't know. I do like the music a lot. I feel kind of bad that I think a lot of his work was just reused in the sequels and just kind of like insert theme here kind of thing.
I think sometimes when you do your first couple films for soundtracks like that, you just sell your baby.
Yeah.
And then they can cut. They can do whatever.
Yeah. I will say, and we tease it a little bit, but like the crescendo of the last 5 minutes of the movie are so good.
Yeah.
And, you know, all complaints aside, when the characters and the scenes begin to intermingle and we get our reveal, it's funny that like this down the line, we're still keeping it a secret, but yeah, better for it. For those who never gotten around to seeing a Saw movie,
go see it.
You might actually like it. But yeah, the last 5 minutes build up to such a beautiful, what the fuck?
Yes.
All right, now I'll watch it again with that in mind and see how that goes. But the music plays a huge part in that. And there is kind of like a, you know, with the editing and the cinematography, it becomes this like tornado, this like swooping, swinging, spinning crescendo of a film that I think like makes up for all the inadequacies up to that point.
That's what happens in the third one, in the third Saw, and that's why I still kind of like think about that film is just the way that it ends is just like balls to the wall.
Yeah, I think the I wonder if it's no, the second one had great stuff from beginning to end.
Yeah,
I
the
really
second
do
one
like
was
the
much
second
better.
Film. But yeah, they are bottom-heavy movies where that third act, you know, it's not always a reveal, but the sort of culmination of these character stories and the choreography, it's really well executed. Mm-hmm. And the movie plays to that especially well.
The group reviewed U.S. detention and rendition practices since September 11th and concluded U.S. interrogators committed torture while questioning detainees. The top U.S. leadership must be held responsible for that torture. And there's no proof the torture provided authorities with any information to prevent future attacks.
So we can't talk about torture porn as a genre, as part of the, you know, the horror library to draw from without talking about why probably it came about. And again, we can only kind of guess, but people say, people would guess, and tons of scholarly journals written about it, that 9/11 is really kind of what saw the turn of this. And the idea of terrorism, where we didn't really experience it before 2001.
Right. It was usually on foreign shores.
Yeah. I didn't really think about it. If a plane gets hijacked, they might take you to Cuba, but then they're going to let you down and then you can come back.
What are you, 60 years old?
Well,
that
I mean,
hasn't happened since
that's
the 80s.
That's the terror. And then it didn't happen until...
Oh, two Americans. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, 9/11 happens and they're probably like, oh, they're going to take us to Cuba because that's what we know. Like, we never knew terror like that.
That's interesting. That the Saw is certainly a movie about like shocking people out of their apathy,
right?
But yeah, that sort of sea change that happens after 9/11, it kind of like the ultra violence certainly ramps up,
because what it allows us when this terrorism happens, we've never experienced anything like that, and at that time there was a we're gonna kick their ass kind of
so
feeling.
Much so that yeah, when news stories like Abu Ghraib
exactly.
come out and photos and videos of torture
and
become
what
public.
Happened was Americans saw that, but still were in such a we're going to kick their ass kind of thing for what they did to us. They saw it. They saw what was happening. They knew what was happening. They knew it was wrong, but they didn't care.
It was,
and
it
I
was
think
still
that was a
other.
Lot of people. Yeah, I think a lot of people then there was this huge apathy, and as a writer, as a filmmaker, they were like, people can tolerate this stuff. Like, what else can they tolerate? Let's show it.
No matter what I put in a movie, there's nothing worse than what's going on in New Orleans. I mean, I can put the most violent stuff in a film and people know it's fake. They're paying for a fantasy. They've seen the actors on TV doing interviews. They know they're alive. So it allows them to enjoy the violence. What gets people desensitized is when there's school shootings every week. It's when we say, oh, another 10 people were killed in Iraq. When we have this chimpanzee running the country, running America, and you feel like the inmates are running the asylum. Like George Bush and Dick Cheney kill people for real. So that, I think, is what gets people desensitized. When they turn on the TV and they've seen that New Orleans has completely fallen apart and people are screaming for help and shooting each other and raping each other, and it takes the U.S. Army 5 days to show up. That's what gets people desensitized. It's not movies or video games. That's a reaction to that. What's going on in New Orleans is so much more horrifying than anything I could ever put in a movie, and it's real. And that makes people think, God, you know what? There's no police. There's no army. No one's going to save us. Everything's going to fall apart. There's horrible racial tension, and nobody's in charge. That's what gets people desensitized, the more that stuff happens.
Abu Ghraib specifically, mm-hmm. like, that wasn't – those weren't – war conditions. That was a prison. That was a subject not unlike Lee Whannell and Cary Elwes in that room, subject to the whims of CIA designed torture.
Right.
Being executed by the low level guys and whatever the responsibility. No one ever really got in proper trouble for that. They wrote off the ones doing the torture as rotten apples at
right.
the time. But you know, our tax dollars fucking paid for it.
Yeah, well, they're still finding, like, people from, you know, Serbia. A guy just went to prison last year from those wars, so...
It's kind of a dark direction as compared... So one of the things that kept occurring to me, especially in the context of the articles that kind of talked about the cultural shift after 9/11 and the sort of the immediacy of, it could be us. We could be the victims of this. Grand Guignol, after, at the time, I guess, more World War I, people lost their taste for violence.
Right.
And that was, World War II, it was unthinkable that it could happen again at the time. But there was something to the idea that the, you know, horror culture, the Grand Guignol live performance theater that incorporated blood and torture and gallows humor, that people no longer were interested in it because they had seen the real thing up close.
Right.
And they no longer had a taste for violence and punishment and torture. And I it's weird to think that after 9/11, we've kind of gone the other way.
Yeah, they developed a taste for torture. Right. They developed a taste because it became a vengeance.
It became justified in cases mm-hmm. like the show 24.
Right.
I never really got into it. I don't think I got into it deep enough to watch any of the torture, but like those were frightening stories when American torturers were referencing 24 for creative means to interrogate,
right?
You know, supposed terrorists.
Justified like interrogation or whatever.
And like Jack Bauer is a fucking hero. Like people treat him
They love Jack Bauer.
It makes me a little uncomfortable. I don't know. There's not really any going back to like moderate times. So I don't know.
No,
that does give me pause that like, is it just going to get weirder? Like,
well, so
I've never seen a Serbian film, but that is one that is regarded as, crossing any number of lines and shattering taboos, that involve babies. I think that prop just went up for sale online. It drew up some attention.
My kind of thinking then is, if we were to make a prediction, thinking about what we have going on now, children in cages, and some of
being drugged,
being taken away, ripped away from their families, things like that. So my kind of thinking is what kind of film would come out of that. And I think in a year or 2 years, we're going to see a lot of abduction films.
See that.
And I would be interested to see if that's kind of the way that film goes then as a reaction to that.
Because of the obvious threat to untold numbers of citizens, and because of the crisis which is even now developing, this radio station will remain on the air day and night.
One final thought on just the name torture porn. In 1968, Variety magazine did a review about Night of the Living Dead, and they called it pornography of violence.
Wow.
And I kind of think that's then where we came to in 2004. This is how we became torture porn.
For Night of the Living Dead.
Pornography of violence.
That's pretty wild. There's always a threshold, right? There's a cultural threshold. And at the time, 1968, Night of the Living Dead, people were pretty fucking freaked out. Like that was crossing some lines for a lot of people. It's funny to think that like, yeah, at the time it inspired outrage. And like disgust. Yeah, that's exactly the kind of writer who would later, you know, sort of disregard torture porn as just like a
silly,
you know, a useless appendage of the film genres.
So for this episode on torture porn, we're going to leave it there. There's so much.
How many times
so
do you think
much.
We said torture porn in the last 45 minutes?
I don't like
minutes.
To say it. It makes me feel weird. But we're going to leave it there for right now. If you want to see us, you can follow us on all social media. We are on Instagram. We are on Twitter. We are on Facebook. Drop us a line at therantsmacabre@gmail.com. Tell us what you think or whatever. It depends on your opinions, really.
We love hearing from you guys. We're still waiting to hear some details of favorite music scores for films, horror films, favorite themes. I don't know. We might have missed some stuff. Well, we definitely missed some stuff.
I mean, there's a vast.
You let us know.
Yeah.
We've also got a Patreon page where you can find even more content. We've got whole episodes. We've got music. We've got sketches. We've got a...
What was this month's about?
We did Gaslight.
I don't think that's what we did.
Am I misremembering? Oh, you son of a bitch.
Gaslighting.
We did the 1944 film as well as the, I don't know, the state of politics.
Yeah.
But yeah, we'll leave it there. We've also, so on iTunes, you can drop us a review, whether it's iTunes or Google Play Music or Stitcher Internet Radio. Drop us a review, give us a couple stars, share the wealth. We love hearing from you guys either way. So looking forward to that. I'm going to let that be it. This is me, Darren, signing off.
This is Mindy. Thanks.
The Rants Macabre. Cutting.
Cultured.
And curated.
And curated. And curated. And curated.